From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. American taxpayers already know that the collapsed SNLs will cost us billions of dollars. Now it looks like we may have to pay to save the commercial banks as well. On this edition of Fresh Air, we examine the banking crisis with Washington Post reporter Jerry Knight. Also today, poet and NPR commentator Andrei Codrescu tells us about his return to Romania. It's the subject of his new book, The Hole in the Flag. And John Leonard reviews a new collection of essays by Václav Havel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House said today that President Bush will meet next week with Russian President Boris Yeltsin in Washington. Yeltsin will be making the trip at the invitation of members of Congress to celebrate his victory as the first ever popularly elected president of the Russian Federation. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the invitation was issued before Yeltsin was declared the winner. Fitzwater said the Russian election was a good sign in the sense of reform and democracy. He stressed that the Bush administration wants to avoid drawing any comparisons between Yeltsin and his rival, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. Eight former Iranian hostages called on Congress today to launch a full-scale investigation into allegations that the Reagan presidential campaign worked out a deal to delay their release and may have tipped off the Iranians on plans for a second rescue mission. NPR's Caroline Clark has more.
The group of former hostages says congressional subpoena power would enable the investigators to gain access to campaign files, passports, and FAA records, the types of information needed to evaluate the validity of the allegations against the Reagan campaign. Former hostage Moorhead Kennedy says after years of not believing the rumors, he's now giving them more weight.
My own feeling from some reading of the evidence and a gut feeling is that something probably happened. But I wouldn't go beyond that because I think this is not for us to say at this point. This is for an investigation to determine.
Democratic Congressman Butler Derrick agrees. He denies that Congress has been dragging its feet on the matter, adding that a preliminary staff review of the allegations should be ready in several weeks. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
The geomagnetic storm that started late yesterday afternoon has continued unabated today. David Spike, a solar forecaster with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says the disturbed conditions will continue through this evening.
We've become technologically more vulnerable to what the sun has put out for many billions of years. Communication systems are disrupted. The different satellites have what are called satellite anomalies, where they can have interruptions or changes of their software programming. And also the power companies see an increase in induced current that comes from moving the Earth's field around. The most obvious manifestation of these geomagnetic storms is the aurora. People in the northeastern U.S. and the northwest should see a pretty good display if their skies are clear.
Spike says the storm caused some power company problems, mostly in the northeast, but there were no power outages. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close at 2,965. Advances edged declines in moderate trading. This is NPR. British Prime Minister John Major said today that he's invited Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev to London to address the leaders of the world's most powerful industrial nations. Major said that Gorbachev would be invited to speak to the group of seven members after their yearly summit meeting is over. Gorbachev had asked for the invitation so that he could make a personal appeal for financial help in resolving his nation's economic crisis. The Soviet president has said that his reforms will not succeed without substantial help from the West. The crew of the space shuttle Columbia is troubleshooting a faulty onboard refrigeration unit today. Meanwhile, the shuttle is scheduled to return to Earth tomorrow morning following more than 9 days in space. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The space shuttle Columbia is scheduled to touch down at 8:40 a.m. Pacific time on one of the concrete runways at Edwards Air Force Base in California. Ground controllers will be keeping a close eye on the shuttle just a few hours prior to that when it comes time to close Columbia's payload bay doors. A ripped piece of weather stripping may interfere with the closing of those doors, although tests on the ground indicated that it should not be a problem. The seven-member crew will wind up 9 days of research on themselves, some rats, and more than 2,000 jellyfish. The research will not end there, however, as each crew member will be monitored continuously to see how the resumption of gravity affects the human body. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The Pentagon said today that the weapons stored at Clark Air Base in the Philippines are safe and secure, despite the threat from the eruptions of Mount Pinatubo. Some 15,000 American service people and their dependents have been evacuated from the base. Spokesman Pete Williams said the weapons at Clark are being guarded by a 1,500-member security force that remains on the base. Williams refused to confirm or deny the presence of nuclear weapons on the base, information that was demanded by a member of the Philippine Senate today. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The commercial banking crisis keeps looking worse. This week, the chairman of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, projected that there will be a greater number of bank failures and they will be more costly than he had projected just a few months ago. And the head of the General Accounting Office, the government's chief accountant, said it's becoming increasingly possible that the taxpayers will have to step in and bail out the FDIC. Even though the banking crisis may hit us where it hurts, in our savings and in our taxes, many of us find it almost too complex an issue to follow. So we asked Jerry Knight to give us some easy-to-follow background on the banking crisis. Knight is a reporter for The Washington Post, and he's been covering the crises in commercial banks and savings and loans. I asked him if he thinks the commercial banks are heading toward a fiasco similar to the savings and loan disaster.
Well, that's the downside risk, or that we will have something as serious as the SNLs. I think most banking experts now would say it's not going to be that bad. But we have, since this whole thing began to play out 4 or 5 years ago, closed down 2,000 banks and savings and loans. Charles Bauscher of the GAO says the government has written checks in the last 2.5 years for $200 billion to protect the depositors in savings and loans and banks. The banks are the small part of that now. But if the economy gets bad, and that's really the fear, that the recovery from the recession will not occur quickly, or that some outside event will knock the economy back down again, then the banks could be in very serious trouble.
Let's look at some of the reasons why some commercial banks are failing. What's the connection between bank failures and the bust in the real estate market?
Well, the real estate market is the number one problem behind all of this. In fact, there are many people who believe that we don't have a banking and S&L crisis. We have a real estate crisis in this country. Over the past decade, for a variety of reasons having to do with tax laws and financing, and we have built billions and billions of dollars worth of office buildings and shopping centers and apartments that we don't need. They're sitting vacant. Most of those were financed by banks and savings and loans. And the mortgages on those properties aren't being paid. That means the lenders are really losing a lot of money. So if we could turn the economy around, if we could find people to move into all those see-through office buildings, we could certainly get the banks healthy very quickly, but no one expects that to happen. We see a period of slow growth ahead for the economy, and until we can start filling up those buildings, the banks and the S&Ls are going to have a lot of trouble.
There were also a lot of financial changes in the 80s that I think helped along the banking crisis, the crisis in the commercial banks. What were some of those financial changes?
Well, we had a lot of deregulation in the last 15, 20 years in banking, in which we changed the rules of banking and allowed banks to get into new ventures. This was particularly true in the savings and loan industry. The S&Ls got into trouble really a decade ago because of high interest rates. Congress didn't want to write a check then to pay off their losses. So they decided to give them a chance to work their way out of it. And the idea was to let them try, instead of just financing home mortgages for you and me, to let savings and loans finance office buildings and apartments and shopping centers. That proved to be a major disaster because they didn't know the business very well, and they moved into it just at a time when this overbuilding was beginning. So that was one of the big changes in the that caused a lot of problems. And there was a philosophy during the early days of the Reagan administration that the government was too aggressive as a regulator. So the regulators kind of backed off. They got the message from the voters that people didn't like the government on their backs. And as a result, just as the SNLs and the banks were getting into new ventures, we pulled the cops off the beat. And the result is what you see today.
What are some of the changes that affected commercial banks?
Well, commercial banks' problem was competition. The bank's best customers have not been you and me. They've been corporations, the General Motors, the big companies that borrow very large amounts of money and are rather steady about paying it back. That's the bread was the bread and butter business for big banks. General Motors found out that it didn't need a bank. It could sell notes. It could borrow money from you and me or from other corporations a whole lot cheaper than it could borrow from a bank. And that took away some of the bank's customers. As a result, the banks moved into other lines of business, and some of them weren't very good. One of their biggest mistakes was deciding to lend a lot of money to small, struggling, needy countries in other parts of the world. It was a good idea. It was in terms of foreign policy. It was encouraged by our government. But it turns out that a lot of those countries simply couldn't pay their loans back. And so the banks are saddled with a very large portfolio of non-performing third world loans.
Were there other risky ventures that the banks invested in to compensate for large corporations going elsewhere for their money?
Well, they looked around for a little of everything. One of the things we all know about is credit cards. A decade ago, credit cards were a little hard to get. Now every bank in America is shoveling them out at us. And as the economy slows down, the banks are going to be finding out right now for the first time what happens to all this consumer debt in a serious recession. And the answer is that we're slow to pay. Some of us can't make our payments. We get laid off from our jobs. We find our part-time employment drying up. And credit card delinquencies have started to move up. This has been very profitable business because they charge quite high rates on it. But the losses are beginning to eat into the profits of the credit card business, and that could be another problem in the times ahead.
We're talking about the crisis in commercial banking, and my guest is Jerry Knight, and he's been writing about the SNL and the commercial banking crisis for The Washington Post. One of the things that the banks are that banks who are on the verge of collapse, one of the things they're looking for is money to help get them back on their feet. And Henry Gonzalez, who's the head of the House Banking Committee, has accused the Federal Reserve Board of adding to the cost of bank failures by lending money to banks that are broke to prop them up. But Gonzalez says that 90% of all banks that receive these loans eventually fail. Then the FDIC ends up having to repay the loans. Can you elaborate on why these Federal Reserve Board loans are very controversial?
Well, let's step back a little and see how the job of the bank insurance funds, the FDIC and the fund that insures savings and loan accounts, have changed in the last decade. Mm-hmm. It used to be, when there weren't very many bank failures, that the FDIC was essentially an undertaker. A bank got in trouble, the regulator stepped in, they shut them down, and then they either paid off the deposits by writing everybody checks, or they transferred the accounts to another nearby bank, and the bank took them over. And in the process, the FDIC paid that bank to take care of its problems for it. As the situation has gotten more and more out of control, the FDIC simply doesn't have the people to do that, and it doesn't have the money. So they have looked for creative ways to stall bank failures, to hold them off, to give them what I call a soft landing, so that we don't have bank runs anymore, but what we do have are banks that go out of business rather slowly over a year or two. One of the techniques that's been used that most of us didn't realize what was going on, even people who followed the banking industry didn't realize what was going on, was that the Federal Reserve would start to give loans to banks when they got in trouble. The depositors would recognize there was something wrong there and slowly start taking their money out, and the Federal Reserve would make up that money with loans, and that would enable the banks like the giant Bank of New England that failed in January to stay in business for a year or two after it might otherwise have failed. That's probably all to the good because it allowed that bank failure to be managed. The bank slowly shrunk and the government slowly shut them down. But it cost a lot of money, and people don't think that was fair, that the government would, without telling anybody, start providing loans to a big troubled bank to help them into this process.
Now, I think some critics see the techniques that you're talking about as a way to postpone
the real banking crisis to postpone it until after the election.
Well, that's the fear, that these things don't solve the problem. They put it off. The SNL crisis really started to blow up 3 years ago, but the political leaders in the Reagan administration did not want to have this thing happening in a presidential election year. So they did a very successful job of postponing it, sliding it over until so that when George Bush was elected, he could come in and early in his administration announce a plan to clean up the SNL industry. And that plan has worked well. But it probably added billions of dollars to the cost, and it looks like that may be happening now. There is a great temptation to try to paper over the process to the problem, to push it forward 2 or 3 years. That's motivated not only by politics, but by the reality that the bank regulators are simply swamped. They have so much to do that they can't handle it all. The FDIC and the Resolution Trust Corporation, the new agency that shuts down savings and loans, have hired thousands of new employees. They're the growth industry of Washington now. They've made up for all the cutbacks in other government agencies. But they can't keep up with the pace. You know, when you shut down a bank, you got to pay off the depositors. That if you do that directly, that means writing a lot of checks, and you can't simply do that with computers. It takes accountants to go in and see who's got the money. And once you've paid off the depositors, then you're stuck with all the bad loans, all the repossessed real estate, the job of shutting down all those branches. It's a big task, and it's just overwhelming the federal regulators. So they're looking for ways to stall this just so they can handle the workload, to put it off till next year or the year after so they can get a little bit caught up on this backlog of bad banks.
So nobody wants to deal with the bank crisis now, but by putting it off 1 or 2 or 3 years, is the bill going to be a lot larger?
Everybody assumes that. It's a very risky venture, not only because it runs up the cost, but because it leaves us vulnerable to some kind of an external crisis. If something should happen that would push the country back into a serious recession, if perhaps some of the third world countries that are now paying their debts to the big banks suddenly couldn't pay, we could be in a real spot. The fear of some outside event, I think, is one of the things that most concerns people like Henry Gonzalez, that something could go wrong with this stalling strategy and we'd have a crisis on our hands that the regulators simply couldn't manage.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Knight. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, and he's been covering the banking crisis in both the SNLs and the commercial banks. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Jerry Knight is my guest, and he's been covering the banking crisis for The Washington Post. There are some very big banks that are predicted to fail this year. What would that mean if a really large bank were to fail? And banks I've seen on the critically wounded list include Citibank, Chase Manhattan, First Chicago.
The big banks are the imponderable issue in this whole affair. It's easy to tell when a little small town bank with a few thousand depositors and $100 million in assets or deposits is in trouble. Their financial affairs are not too complicated. But when you get to a worldwide organization, it's very difficult for bank examiners to really know how healthy they are. It's hard to tell about that loan you made to finance a plant in Borneo, and there are literally things like that in the portfolios of all the biggest banks. So we have to make a lot of judgment calls. The regulators can't look at every piece of their records at every loan they've ever made. So those banks are the most difficult to assess, and they're the most dangerous, because when a Citibank, the biggest bank in the country, goes under, the cost would be $5 or $10 billion. That would overwhelm all the banks in many states just paying for that one.
Some critics of the way the banking crisis is being handled say that there's a double standard that's being practiced. And that more attention is being paid to banks that are too big to fail. And an example that's often used is how the Bank of New England was bailed out in a way that the smaller Bank of Harlem was not.
That's right. There is a double standard in banking today in the way bank failures are handled, and everybody admits it. It is perhaps the most explosive political issue in this whole situation, even more than the money, because it is so blatantly unfair. When Freedom National Bank in Harlem, which was at the time the biggest black bank in the country, got in trouble, the regulators simply shut it down, and people who had more than $100,000 in their accounts lost all that money. That included several church groups, some anti-poverty organizations, some community organizations, and some businesses that had put money in there as a favor to help the bank. On the other hand, when the Bank of New England in Boston failed earlier this year, everybody was protected, no matter how much they had in their account. Even overseas accounts that aren't covered by federal deposit insurance were taken care of. The justification for this, and it is a justification, is that Bank of New England was essential to the Boston economy. If that bank had closed down, the chaos would have spread through New England, and all of Boston might have had a financial panic. The trouble with that justification is that it doesn't really answer the questions of the people in Harlem. Now, one answer would be, let's insure everybody, but that would cost a lot of money. There is a determination in Congress that something will be done about this. There are people who say there will be no banking legislation this year until too big to fail is changed. But there's no good way out of it, because there are always going to be banks, Citibank in New York, for example, that we can't afford to simply shut down because they have such worldwide connections.
Let's look at some of the proposals to reorganize commercial banking. One of the proposals is to further deregulate the commercial banks and allow them to sell insurance, to sell stocks and bonds. What would that mean if they branched out into those areas?
The question of giving banks new powers, there are really two issues here. One is the sort of right and wrong economic issue, and the other one is raw politics. The Bush administration makes the case that banks would benefit and consumers would benefit if we had sort of financial supermarkets, if you could drop into your local bank and you could buy life insurance and you could buy a mutual fund or you could handle some of your other financial affairs. That makes a lot of sense philosophically, but the insurance agents of the world sure don't like it. The mutual fund companies don't like it. The Wall Street brokerage houses don't like it. So the issue of giving banks new powers is likely to be decided not on the economics of it or not on the philosophy, but on the power of the various industries to protect their own territory from competition. That fight is so intense that it could stop banking reform legislation.
Now, some experts say that it was the deregulation of the savings and loans that helped lead to the savings and loan crisis. Do you think that deregulation in commercial banking might lead to new crises down the line for commercial banks?
That's a tough one to call. The deregulation in savings and loans unquestionably caused this problem. We let people who had been making simple home loans all their lives start buying fast food franchises and financing wind farms and speculative office buildings, and they did what a lot of people do when they get in something new. They failed miserably. If banks make the same mistakes, deregulation could be a disaster. Now, advocates of deregulation say, no, we're going to protect that. We're going to set up firewalls between the bank that's protected by the taxpayers and these new business ventures. And those firewalls will prevent the banks from making mistakes in, say, the insurance business and then going out of the business. The effectiveness of firewalls is open to question because we've never had a system quite like that. We don't know whether it'll work. A lot of people in Congress simply don't feel comfortable with letting banks get into new ventures at a time when they're clearly having trouble running their own businesses. And as John Dingell, one of the most powerful members of Congress, pointed out this week, Wall Street securities firms lost money last year. The industry is in very tough times. Letting banks get into that business is not going to let banks make any more money. They'll just lose money along with everybody else. And as Dingell says, the insurance industry is facing many of the same problems of the banks. Letting banks into insurance is not going to cure them, he argues. That's a pretty persuasive argument to a lot of members of Congress.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Knight, and he's been covering the banking crisis for The Washington Post. As we're staring at the possibility of a crisis in commercial banking, we're already paying a staggering bill for the SNL crisis. Are there lessons from the SNL crisis that we should be applying to commercial banks now?
Well, I think the most important lesson in Washington is not to let things get out of control. And there is more than a little concern here that we haven't learned that lesson very well, that the bank situation is deteriorating very rapidly, just as the SNLs did, and that if Congress doesn't move quickly, we'll be in a lot of trouble. The FDIC now is down to its last $2 or $3 billion. That's not much money when a Bank of New England failure alone can cost $3 billion. They'll probably be broke by the end of the year. So a lot of people in Congress say the first thing we should do is give the FDIC some money and stop all this debate about new bank powers and deregulation or re-regulation and just get the money there. The Bush administration doesn't want to do that. Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady repeatedly makes the point that we shouldn't just throw money at this problem, we should cure it. And he makes a pretty persuasive argument that money alone won't get us through this situation.
The banking crisis is pretty complicated, pretty hard to understand. And because of that, it's usually not an issue that's discussed in election campaigns. It's hard to boil it down to sound bites. How does that affect the way the banking crisis is actually being dealt with in Congress and by the president?
Yeah, that's a good point. Not long ago, the House Banking Committee was debating a very obscure provision involving the regulation of foreign banks that operate in this country. And Congressman Jerry Kleshka from Wisconsin kind of leaned back in his chair and whispered to his next-door neighbor, "Boy, I'll bet we're getting a lot of mail from home on this one." And the whole panel laughed. And in fact, Congressman Chuck Schumer of New York piped in and said, "I haven't gotten any mail from home on any issue in this bill." What that means is that the people of America aren't being heard on this issue. They simply don't understand it. The voices that are being heard are the special interests. The big banks are being heard from. The Wall Street brokers are being heard from. The insurance industry has six different organizations lobbying on the banking bill. But the people's voices are not being heard on this issue. And as a result, there's more than a little concern that the people's interests may not be served when this bill is written.
I'm sure one thing that all of our listeners want to know who have any money in commercial banks right now is, how do you know if your bank is safe?
Well, the advice I give people is that no one should have more than $100,000 in any account in any bank.
That's the limit that
That's
the FDIC
the limit
will
of
insure.
FDIC insurance. In most cases, the FDIC insures all accounts, but there's no reason to take that chance. There's no reason to put more than $100,000 in one account. If you have that kind of money, it's very simple to put it in two accounts, in two banks, and you'll be safe. Evaluating the health of the bank is something that government auditors and bank examiners can't agree on, and it is, I think, hopeless to expect the depositor to make a decision over whether his or her bank is really safe. The answer is, there's insurance there up to $100,000. Take advantage of it. Don't take any risks.
Jerry Knight, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jerry Knight writes for The Washington Post, where he's covering the banking crisis, the SNL, and the commercial banking crisis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, baby, what I couldn't do with plenty of money and you, in spite of the worry that money brings, just a little filthy lucre buys a lot of things. And I could take you to places that you would like to go, but outside of that I've no use for dough. It's the root of all evil, of strife and upheaval. But I'm certain, honey, that life would be sunny with plenty of money and you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Like many Romanians, NPR commentator Andrei Codrescu was elated when the dictator Ceausescu was deposed. But that excitement has since given way to cynicism. Coming up, Andrei Codrescu on his country's staged revolution. His return to Romania is the subject of his new book, The Hole in the Flag. Also, John Leonard reviews a new collection of essays by Václav Havel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Radical Russian Republic leader Boris Yeltsin has been declared the winner of yesterday's presidential election. The Soviet news agency TASS says the Russian Election Commission reported that Yeltsin won the balloting with about 60% of the vote. No runoff will be necessary. Yeltsin hopes to transform the Russian economy into a market-oriented one as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, voters in Leningrad have decided that they want the name of their city changed. Voters have approved a return to St. Petersburg, the city's old Tsarist name. The vote was 55% in favor. The name change vote is not binding. Only the national parliament can approve the change, but the ballot result is a strong blow to Lenin's legacy. President Gorbachev opposed the name change. British Prime Minister John Major confirmed today that he's invited Soviet President Gorbachev to London to meet the leaders of the Group of Seven industrial nations after their summit in July. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The Prime Minister made his announcement during question time at the House of Commons. He told Parliament that the invitation was issued after consulting other leaders of the Group of Seven. He added that an envoy had brought him a message from the Soviet leader yesterday, reaffirming his commitment to political and economic reform. Gorbachev had been lobbying for an invitation to the summit itself, but both the United States and Japan had expressed reservations about inviting him before the G7 had decided how to respond to his requests for massive economic aid. The British plan of inviting Gorbachev to meet immediately afterwards with the G7 leaders was seen as a reasonable compromise. Major also said Gorbachev would stay in London after the talks for bilateral discussions with Britain. In London, this is Michael Goldfarb.
Pablo Escobar, a leader of the Medellin cocaine cartel, is expected to turn himself into authorities any day now. But that process could have been hindered by a Washington Post editorial which criticized Colombian authorities for making the jail too luxurious. Ken Dermata reports from Bogota.
Pablo Escobar confided to a television evangelist that he would turn himself into authorities weeks ago. But so far, the world's most sought-after criminal is still on the run. Dozens of journalists have been camped out for days in a Medellin suburb at the entrance to the jail, which was specially built to house Escobar and 20 of his lieutenants. Escobar's surrender was the subject of a Washington Post editorial entitled Hotel Escobar, which said the jail was too cozy. From his clandestine hideout, an angry Escobar demanded that journalists be given a tour of the jail. Justice Minister Jaime Giraldo granted that permission early this morning. Journalists got the first look at Escobar's cell, which may be nicer than the average jail, but they concluded it's still a jail. For National Public Radio, I'm Ken Dermata in Bogota.
On Wall Street today, stocks rose 3 points to close at 29.65.12. This is NPR News. The Centers for Disease Control reported today that more than 1 million babies are born to unmarried mothers every year in the United States. That accounts for 26% of all births. The agency said there's a growing need to focus on prenatal care for women who are least likely to receive it. The CDC said many unmarried moms are likely to have low birth weight babies. Infants born to unmarried women and to teenagers are at high risk because of factors affecting maternal health, such as poverty, poor nutrition, and lack of access to health care. A police helicopter crashed in southwest Los Angeles today. Two officers on board and a man working on the ground were killed. Frank Stoltz of station KLON has more.
Police say the helicopter had just begun a two-hour shift of routine air patrol when the pilot radioed police headquarters and said he was having engine trouble. Moments later, the helicopter crashed into a small parking lot across the street from Normandy Elementary School. Lucille Burris is a crossing guard at the intersection where the plane went down. She says she had just crossed the street when she looked up and saw the helicopter falling.
And I began to run. And as I began to run, I heard it when it fell, and it was a great impact.
Witnesses who saw the helicopter earlier said they believe the pilot did everything he could to miss the school. Police say they're investigating the cause of the crash. Another L.A. police helicopter of the same make and model experienced mechanical problems about a year and a half ago and was forced into an emergency landing. For National Public Radio, I'm Frank Stoltz in Los Angeles.
The Nicaraguan Army says a group of about 40 former Contra rebels, some armed, raided a northern town today. Three warehouses and a bank were robbed. The Re-Contras, as they call themselves, blocked highways near the town and took clothes and farm tools and about $8,000 in cash. The Re-Contras say they've been threatened by the Sandinista Army. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In December 1989, the revolutions sweeping Eastern Europe hit Romania. We all saw the gruesome pictures of the murdered Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu and his wife Elena. But today there are people inside and outside Romania who wonder what has really changed there. Poet Andrei Codrescu is among those who believe that the revolution in Romania wasn't a revolution at all, that it was a staged uprising to get rid of Ceausescu and shuffle the leadership of the Communist Party. Codrescu returned to Romania days after the revolution with several of his colleagues from National Public Radio. He made a second trip to Romania last summer for his 25th high school reunion. It also marked the 25th anniversary of his emigration. He reported on his trips to Romania for All Things Considered and Nightline. These trips are now the subject of his new book, The Hole in the Flag. Listeners to All Things Considered know Codrescu for his skeptical commentaries on American culture as seen through the eyes of an exile. I asked him about the first signs he observed in Romania that indicated the revolution wasn't what it appeared to be.
The reports about the fighting that was going on seemed exaggerated even to the people who were reporting them. In Bucharest, the fighting was going on only at night. Nobody really saw any bodies except when they were being displayed by the newly appointed members of the National Salvation Front. The National Salvation Front, which was the new government, appeared spontaneously on television, or so it seemed to everyone, and yet all the members of the front had links to the old Communist Party and links that went very deep. And we knew all this business. We also knew that certain of the images that we were being fed were not they were disputed. So there was quite a bit of whispering going on about what we were seeing. But we wanted to believe that the year 1989, which had seen the collapse of one red fascist bureaucracy after another, would have this spectacular closure. We managed to convey that impression. Unfortunately, that's not exactly what happened.
Well, one of the things that made you and many other people suspicious was that the Romanian TV never stopped broadcasting during the revolution in December, even though the TV station was allegedly a target of Ceausescu.
Well, the TV station was under attack, and it was broadcasting reports of itself being under attack. It was truly a postmodern moment of this TV revolution, which was conducted entirely on television. It would have seemed very easy for Ceausescu loyalists, if indeed there were any, to knock out the transmission tower or somehow put this single source of news about the revolution out of business, but they didn't. The generals were conducting their field operations or their seeming field operations from telephones in the television studios. And yet, at the same time, there was a spontaneous kind of television being made because people were coming in from the streets to tell their stories, and they were allowed into the TV before the cameras to speak uncensored, and they did so for a long time, and some extraordinary stories were heard in those days. So side by side with spontaneity and then a real revolt, we also saw things that were clearly staged.
Who do you think was behind the staged part of the revolution?
Well, there are three branches to this conspiracy. One was based in Securitate, in the secret police, another in the army, and there were people within the Communist Party as well. And the conspiracy was directed mainly at the Ceausescus. They had attempted once before to get rid of the Ceausescus, but the Soviets, who were keeping a pretty close watch on this, did not give their approval at that time. But in 1989, with all the things going on in Eastern Europe, Ceausescu had become an embarrassment to the Soviets, and I think that the KGB had a big hand in it.
Andrei Kudrescu is my guest. I'm sure you know him as a commentator on NPR's All Things Considered. He's also a poet, and he's a Romanian exile, and he returned to Romania right after the revolution, and that's the subject of his new book, The Hole in the Flag. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Andrei Kudrescu is my guest, and he's written a new book about his return to Romania, and it's called The Hole in the Flag, a Romanian Exile, Story of Return and Revolution. I'm wondering what the experience was like for you as a Romanian and also as a surrealist to go to Romania right after the revolution, to be swept away by the excitement about it, and then to leave feeling that the whole thing, or at least most of it, was actually staged. I mean, there is something very surrealistic about that.
Well, there is nothing surrealist, if I am that indeed, although I'm not sure. Nothing a surrealist loves more than a revolution, because all the orders of reason and what seemed reasonable are toppled, and new kinds of realities we've never seen before make their appearance. Well, in this case, it was more than I had reason to expect. The cynic in me was certainly asleep for a few moments, but the old Romanian suspicion of things that are too overtly one way or another awoke soon enough. I didn't know that things were as complicated and mysterious as all that until I went back. Actually, in December, I still believed that a fundamental change had taken place, and in fact, it had, but not in the system. It had in the minds of the people. I realized what happened when I went back in June for my so-called high school reunion, which wasn't really a high school reunion. It was mostly a few of my old classmates getting together to compare our senses of humor, I guess. And that's when I realized that my old friends from high school had done very well under the old regime, and they were all solid supporters of the new National Salvation Front, which at that time had shown its true colors by violently suppressing demonstrations by students and intellectuals.
Tell me how, during the course of conversations with your old high school friends, you started to realize that these people represented the regime that was in power.
Well, it was a continuous party. I was there for about a week, and Romanians are very warm people and hospitable, and we ate and drank a lot and did what Romanians do best when they do those things, is talk and argue. The arguments were particularly passionate at that moment, as you can imagine, with everything going on. And, of course, I was arguing for the students and for the intellectuals, because I believe still that they are the only force in the country capable of saving Romania from some horrendous fate. They were arguing the side of law and order and of the government, and essentially spouting the official line, which was that the students were all controlled from abroad, and that once more Jews and Hungarians and gypsies and some other unknown international forces were conspiring to destroy the country, which was, in fact, the same propaganda that Ceausescu himself used before.
Let me ask you, when your friends would say that it was the Hungarians and the Jews who were behind it, blah, 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 would you point out that you were a Jew?
Well, they knew this very well. They were making a kind of deliberate exemption, you know.
Not you, all the other Jews.
Exactly. Of course, this business is very ugly right now. If nationalist the hatred of everyone else, and it's reaching truly a horrendous pitch.
What this new nationalism? Or not so new nationalism?
Well, it's not so new, but the form that it is taking now. One of the just recently, last month on May 23rd, a professor at the University of Chicago named Ioan Culianu was assassinated. There are a whole lot of indications that it was a political hit by one of the right-wing Romanian groups that are possibly run by old Securitate people from Romania. And the reason for this assassination, if that's what it was, and a lot of people think that's what it was because he was critical of the new government and of the secret police, and said so in a series of articles. And it's a very tragic thing.
Gee, does that make you worry about your own safety?
Well, yeah, I have some apprehensions. And one of the ways in which I figure, not just to protect myself, but simply to talk about it and bring it to light as much as possible, because if indeed it is a group of these people, then shining light on them will make them scary, the way you put the light on roaches or some horrible thing in the dark.
You and I did an interview before your second trip to Romania, the trip where you went on the high school reunion, and I think your tone has really changed. You just seem a lot more serious now.
Well, yeah, it's darkened a bit. I think much of what all the hopes I had back then were in part my projection and the projection of other people who wanted all the best. But what this past year has done to all of us, actually, is to make us, I think, very circumspect about sentimentality and more aware of the dark forces that are undoubtedly there.
I wonder how you feel that you've been personally changed as a writer by the experience of observing the Romanian Revolution and then observing all the cynicism about it. And I ask that because I know that, for instance, a lot of your commentaries for NPR, even when they're about political issues as opposed to cultural issues, you're usually really writing from a distance and you're finding the humor and the absurdity in events. But this is an event you've been much closer to, and that's just a lot more threatening to you on a personal level because it's your country. And I wonder if you feel changed in a fundamental way by that.
Well, I hope to get back my sense of humor real soon. Because my basic instinct has always been that reality, the way it's constituted, is mostly absurd. And the Romanians all have that sense because you have to have a keen sense of the absurd to survive in a small country at the crossroads of all those big powers in Europe. That's probably my basic view, but I let my guard down for a moment there, and I gave in to the optimism and the hope that that seemed to be everywhere. And then things started to be more like I always thought they were, and now I'm just trying to regain a balance there and find out what the new political jokes are. This is something else, too, that Romanians survived for years by telling political jokes about their leaders, but there is no real new crop of political jokes. I mean, there are political jokes, but they're somehow, they've lost their edge, and probably there is more of a similarity between that and what happened to me. I mean, I'm reflecting in some way the loss of heart to tell jokes.
What effect did it have on you to travel to Romania with journalists from Nightline and from All Things Considered? I think, you know, journalists who are reporting on a story have a different approach than you would because you're looking more for the texture of it, the feel of an event, rather than the facts of it.
Well, we had our problems that way because they were trying to work me in that direction, and I was resisting it the whole time, so I ran away as much as I could. But I ended up doing some journalistic things that helped me, and one of them was translate, because there were never enough translators around, and when I was translating, I didn't have time to feel awkward about my old language. I had to do it. It had to be done quick. So in a way, it helped me reintegrate or quickly go back into the pulse of things there. And translation is another extraordinary story that of all these revolutions in 1989 that wasn't yet told. The kind of mistranslations and changes from one perspective to another, and the way the journalists looked at things, and the way the translators translated, and the actual things that people said. There's some amazingly vast and interesting writer's story in there.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I had a moment when we interviewed the chief architect of Romania, who was the monster in charge of Ceausescu's program of raising peasant villages and building huge new cement monsters. And the man was so loathsome to me that when he was telling us things, he did so in a very mild and well-polished bureaucratic tone, but I ended up putting a lot of my own feelings into the translation, so I made him seem more hateful than he appeared.
Well, how do you feel about having done that?
Great.
Well, I bet the people you translated for didn't feel so great about it. I mean, or wouldn't feel so great about it if they knew that you were exaggerating.
Well, that's why they're journalists and I'm a poet.
Do they know now that?
Yeah, well, they didn't like him either, I don't think, but they wouldn't. They are journalists, and well, we did a lot around that story, so clearly, that particular moment didn't matter all that much.
So, is your name blacklisted or not blacklisted now in Romania? Do you know?
Well, no, it's not in the sense that the writers are. I'm going to have two books published there, a book of poetry in the fall, and the essay that we discussed last time on your show, The Disappearance of the Outside. So I'm being reclaimed for Romanian literature in an amazing way. I'm making my reappearance years later in translation. I couldn't translate these things myself because all my American work is my adult work, and I was a child when I left, and I don't have the adult Romanian needed to do that.
Andrei, it was good to talk with you again. Thanks very much.
That was great.
My guest has been Andrei Codrescu. He's a commentator for All Things Considered and the author of a new book called The Hole in the Flag, A Romanian Exile Story of Return and Revolution. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Ann Garrels reports tonight from the Republic of Russia in the Soviet Union about the victory there of Boris Yeltsin to be the first popularly elected president. We'll talk with a volcanologist about the Ring of Fire in the Pacific, including Mount Unson in Japan and Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. He says it doesn't necessarily portend disaster along that particular tectonic plate. Alex Chadwick has a story about a Boy Scout who contracted AIDS through a transfusion and is now conducting an AIDS awareness campaign. Also, letters from listeners tonight about military parades and about safe sex.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new collection of writings by Václav Havel dating from 1965 through 1990. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Open Letters.
Václav Havel isn't perfect. The playwright president of Czechoslovakia has his problems with feminism, though they make him feel guilty. And he misconstrues the meaning of the peace movement in the West, which had a livelier sense of the possibility of change in Eastern Europe than did many dissidents. But compared to anybody else in power in the world today, Havel is downright heroic, self-deprecating, ambivalent, whimsical, a gentle ironist, a sort of intellectual Ferdinand the Bull. As far back as 1965, he seceded from what he calls the post-totalitarian panorama of pseudo-history and automatism, the spiderweb of faceless flunkies and anonymous informers and secret police. He chose to behave as if he were free. He calls this living within the truth. And because of it, his plays were banned, he had to work in a brewery, and he went to prison for 4 years. Even so, he never gave a thought to leaving Czechoslovakia, though he won't hold it against anyone who did choose to emigrate. What kind of human rights activists would we be, he asks, if we were to deny people the right that every swallow has? These letters, to politicians, to unions, to organizations that gave him prizes, to colleagues in dissident movements like Solidarity, to readers of Western magazines like Encounter, are the public evidence of his living within the truth. They're less scattershot than last year's book-length interview, Disturbing the Peace, and a lot more stirring than his letters to Olga from prison. Even as he proposes a second culture, a parallel structure of samizdat publications, underground theaters, private universities, he creates this culture, an existential revolution of free thought and alternative values that undermines the police state world of appearances, of ritual, facades, and excuses. Whether it's a workers' strike, or a rock concert, or a student demonstration, or refusing to vote in the farcical elections, by behaving as if we are free, we rehabilitate, he says, values like trust, openness, responsibility, solidarity, love. We renew, he says, relations to a world where categories like justice, honor, treason, friendship, infidelity, courage, or empathy have a wholly tangible content. We reconstitute, he says, the natural world as the true terrain of politics, personal experience as the initial measure of things, human community as the focus of all action, the autonomous, integral, and dignified human eye. You'll find here Havel's 80-page essay on the power of the powerless. There's not much in it that's shockingly new to any reader of Hannah Arendt, but there wasn't much so shockingly new in Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail to readers of Thoreau on civil disobedience. What made King's letter so important to the civil rights movement, and Havel's essay so crucial to Charter 77 and to Solidarity, was the timing and the craft. Now imagine, if you can, Dr. King as President of the United States. Also included here is Havel's first speech as president in December 1989. Here's how he began. I assume you did not propose me for this office so that I, too, would lie to you. Is there anyone else remotely like him? I'm afraid not. We've been told often enough that this Beatles-loving playwright led the world's first rock and roll revolution. In power in Prague, for a glorious moment, is Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Václav Havel's new collection, Open Letters. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with associate producers Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This year's International Conference on AIDS is about to convene. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the program director of last year's conference, Dr. Robert Wachter. His new book is about trying to create an alliance between scientists at the conference and the AIDS activists who planned to disrupt the gathering. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.